Welcome to the John, Paul, and Mike Show. I'm your co-host, Paul Holmes.
And I'm John Juristic. Good day, Paul. How are you?
I'm terrific, John. How are you doing?
Well, Paul, I know that we try not to date ourselves on the show, but today's my birthday.
What?
Uh-huh.
Well,
oh, yeah.
Happy birthday.
Thank
what are you.
You?
What are you, like 44, 45 now?
Well, I'm just getting into my 30s, so I'm 29. Yeah, so if you believe that, then, oh, well.
Then I guess we shouldn't talk about the new addition to your family then, eh?
I know, another dated thing. I was in Edmonton the past week.
Yeah.
And I'm a grandpa, so clearly not 29.
That is so awesome. Congratulations.
So lots of personal stuff. The week before May 20th is always going to be very busy for us.
And we did this whole show backwards. The upcoming segment was recorded before now, which is all a big trick, right? And we recorded it with you in Edmonton and me in Victoria and, of course, our esteemed, super intelligent guest, Sean Holman, from Calgary. So that was interesting.
That was great. And certainly if the audio turns out well, and I'm certain it will, that's going to open up an amazing new set of interviewees for you and I.
Yeah, basically what I like to sort of call the upcoming segment is the future of the media in Canada. And, you know, even talking to a media expert such as Sean Holman, the reality, of course, is nobody has a crystal ball. We don't really know where all this is going. But one thing we can all agree on is that the media in this world, and especially here in Canada, is sure changing.
Well, even just with the way that we actually undertook the entire interview from three different cities via the internet, that in of itself is fundamental change. But certainly the content of the interview is fascinating, and I think our listeners are going to find it very interesting and will likely lead to more shows.
I just wanted to say crazy milestone for the show this week. We host our show at johnpaulandmike.podbean.com. And Podbean hosts almost a million podcasts around the world. And if you go into the news and politics section there, we were featured as the top show on the entire network.
Oh, come on. I didn't know that.
Blew me away.
Birthday present from you?
You know what? It had nothing to do with me. I don't know if you're paying somebody under the table, but, man, what a shocker when I saw that. And as a result, we're getting listeners from all over North America who are tuning in to hear all the crazy stuff going down here in British Columbia.
Yeah. It sounds like you and I got to ramp up the insanity level then.
It's pretty exciting. And, you know, I figure, you know, our first goal was 12 listeners. Or, you know, this week we busted, you know, a mile through that and we're featured. And so, you know, our next goal is to be featured on iTunes as one of the top podcasts per area. How does that sound?
Well, Paul, that maybe at the beginning of all this I would have said you're crazy, but you're still crazy. But maybe that is actually an achievable goal.
Dream big.
So, Paul, you and I have been in and around the development of internet and how the internet's impacting industry now for better part of 20 years in terms of publishing, education, music. Somewhere along the way, it is impacting journalism. And it doesn't seem as though the industry itself, that being journalism, reporting, investigative reporting, seem to want to admit that, in fact, the internet, the social media, is impacting their industry. I think Sean is trying hard to make some noise about that and doesn't seem to be having a lot of luck. Maybe we will help him along the way.
Yeah, and you know, it's, you know, of all the industries in the world that are affected by the changes in technology, I think the industry that has been disrupted the most is media. And media, of course, old established media, we're very good, very powerful, you know, and well positioned in society. And You know, it's arguable that whole industry as an industry has come down considerably, you know, in stature as a result of all of this. And nobody likes to see that happen to their industry, right? So.
Well, it certainly allows more and more folks to be involved, and it's almost as though the established protocols, established individuals, the companies don't want that to happen. I think it's fantastic. And I think our listeners will enjoy hearing the three of us from all over the place. We don't have a guest for next week, in large part because I've been kicking around all over the place doing stuff.
We have a surprise guest for next week.
Excellent.
Yeah. So stay tuned and find out our surprise guest. And now you can tune into our podcast on our site and on iTunes, and now also on TuneIn Radio as well. So enjoy the show, everybody.
Paul, it's so fun working with you. Thank you very much.
All right. Joining us now is Sean Holman, Assistant Professor of Journalism at Mount Royal University, documentary filmmaker and the founding editor of the pioneering online investigative political news service Public Eye Online. A former syndicated columnist, he also worked as a legislative reporter for 24 Hours, Vancouver, and the Vancouver Sun. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, Paul. How's it going?
Good. quite a difference, I guess, being on our little podcast versus some of the big big journalist projects you've been involved with over your career.
Not at all, Paul. All media projects are potentially big media projects. That's the world we now live in.
And that actually is the first thing I was going to ask you about, Sean. You know, we've known each other for years. We've seen the world change a whole lot in every regard in the last decade. And so, in a nutshell, what's the future of media in Canada?
That's a good question. I don't think that I don't have an enormous amount of confidence in the future of the existing news industry in this country. I do have a lot of confidence in journalism and the continued sustainability of journalism, but I think that the news industry as it stands right now has been a very poor caretaker for that profession, and I think that things are likely going to get worse before they get better.
To a large degree, Sean, it's a reason Paul and I have undertaken to do a weekly podcast where we're not happy with the depth of research, the depth of dialogue that goes on in the traditional media. We're intuitively feeling what you've just stated.
Yeah, I think the problem is right now is that obviously as a result of the internet, as a result of the fall off in advertising revenues, what we are essentially seeing is that media companies are having to do more with less. They have less staff, and yet they need to fill an ever-growing space that is the internet. The internet is a black hole for content. You can shovel as much content as you like into it, and it is never going to be full. Unfortunately, I think that media organizations have made the wrong decision when it comes to the kind of content that they are using to try to fill that hole. It's very tempting for them to cover the low-hanging fruit. It's very tempting for them to simply create content on the basis of news releases and news events, but I don't think that serves the readers very well. I don't think that serves the public interest very well, and I think ultimately it doesn't serve them very well, because with the fall off in advertising revenue, that means they actually need to convince people to pay for their content, and people aren't going to pay for their content if they're seeing the same thing that is being shoveled out on the social media sites for those people that they're covering.
Well, it's funny you say that. You know, the big joke on Reddit is that everything that you see that's funny on Facebook was the stuff that broke on Reddit 2 days earlier. And you know, we used to say the same thing about the local newspaper here in Victoria. Is, you know, that was a really great story. It's too bad they added the spelling errors before they reprinted it from the Wire story 2 days ago, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, if I were advising news leaders in Canada today, what I would tell them is I think we need to be focusing much more on enterprise reporting, reporting that is initiated by reporters rather than initiated by news releases or news events.
Right.
We need to be doing more reporting that focuses on digging up information related to that enterprise. And I do believe that can be done within the context of a daily news environment, which is often the knock against it. I do believe that can be done in the context of budget constraints, which is another knock against it. And I do believe that people want that kind of content. But I think we've gotten into a bit of a trap in this country where there is this belief that enterprise reporting cannot happen within a daily news environment of constrained budgets. But I did that kind of reporting for 9 years on a daily basis, so I do know that it's possible.
Well, and I guess the question for me then, Sean, is, you know, how weird am I as a news consumer being interested in that kind of in-depth reporting? I mean, I'll be honest, you know, we kind of missed when you stopped doing public eye, even though, you know, it was very challenging to try to make that, you know, a career because of this exact same reasons that you indicated with mainstream media. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if I want to know the breaking stories, I'll go to Twitter. And mm-hmm. It doesn't matter whether the Globe and Mail broke it or Joe Smith, who lived down the street. To me, you take it with a grain of salt when it's maybe Joe Smith, right? But at the end of the day, I want a little bit more nuts and bolts. I want to know, you know, what's the background to this, right?
Yeah.
You know, you take the Ukraine situation just as a sort of bland example. There is so much history and, you know, intertwined, you know, stories that kind of led up to where we are today. And I wonder how, you know, the average sort of person, how much of that they even begin to understand. Because I know it myself as a tuned-in, interested person. I find that really complex and, you know, trying to decipher, you know, how we got to this point, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what the media industry needs to realize is that previously it had a monopoly on the ability to get information out to the masses.
Yeah.
And it relied on that monopoly. It had the biggest megaphone out there, and that megaphone meant it could attract substantive audience and a substantive number of advertisers. That monopoly no longer exists, thanks to the internet and thanks to social media. So what the news industry needs to be doing is it needs to be thinking to itself, okay, where can we continue to have a monopoly? And I believe that the kind of information you're talking about, the kind of information I'm talking about, is where the news industry can still have a monopoly. It's unfortunate, I think, that the news industry seems to have been very slow to realize that dynamic. There are some people who do realize that dynamic, but even among those who do, they have been slow to act on that dynamic.
Sean, right. We've had a couple of real-life examples, especially in B.C., a week ago was the one-year anniversary of the provincial election, which I might suggest 95% of the media pundits reported incorrectly. We had a scenario happening in Alberta, the same thing, and now it appears there's conflicting polling coming out of Ontario. So rather than really dwell on what happened, what are you hearing amongst your peers that's going to be changed? How are we going to address this issue that, in fact, that we've just been talking about? In fact, reporters were almost exclusively relying on polling that was wrong.
Yeah, well, no one really has a crystal ball in these kind of moments. But I think one of the things that you are picking up on is the increased difficulty that we are having as journalists to pursue really any kind of reporting that goes beyond the information that is handed to us. You look at the polling industry and some of the challenges that it is facing. People are not, the majority is not, people in the main, as a result of the development of cell phones and as a result of disconnecting from landlines, it is becoming increasingly difficult to, you know, have samples that are accurate. I'm not saying anything new in saying that.
Was it really the mechanism of polling, or was it the real lack of depth of reporting to understand that the key issue in BC was all about jobs and the economy? I mean, that led to a majority win for this government.
But what I think, here's the thing though, right? What we're really talking about when it comes to this particular issue is the absence of information that Canadian reporters in particular have to deal with. Mm-hmm. There is not a lot of good data in this country. There is not a lot of good access to information in this country. And when you have that situation, as a result of polling that has question marks surrounding it, as a result of poor freedom of information laws, as a result of a poisonous PR culture that restricts access to sources, as a result of a whole host of factors, you can't help but get things wrong. I mean, that's simply the reality of it, right? So if we want better journalism, it's also not just about devoting resources to enterprise reporting. It's also giving journalists the power to have access to the information that makes that kind of reporting possible.
It's interesting because you and I have talked about this many times in the past, and I think we've kind of covered polling. It's broken. If a number comes up on my phone that I don't recognize, I just don't answer it anymore.
Yeah.
Right? And so I think, you know, a lot of people are in the same boat. It's got to be really hard for pollsters to figure it out. But there is also a long tradition in this country of gotcha journalism. And when you look at the people surrounding, you know, the PMO and politicians and the PR firms that are working desperately, you know, to counter any negative spin, how much of that is just a reaction to the sort of history of gotcha journalism that that all these politicians are smart enough to recognize is out there, and they just want to avoid that?
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. If I was in their position, if I was a major public or private sector institution, strong PR, strong media relations makes sense. It totally does.
Yeah, yeah.
It absolutely does, right? Why would you go into a situation if you didn't have the maximum amount of control? You
the narrative
have
yeah.
over that situation. Yeah. It totally makes sense. But what I think we need to think about is the impact that is having on democratic society. If access to information and PR is controlling so much these days, how can the citizenry hope to learn the truth? And if they can't learn the truth, what does that mean? I mean, it strikes me that we end up then living in this kind of, with apologies to Carl Sagan, demon-haunted world.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we're not sure what to believe.
Is that government a responsibility, or is that citizenry a responsibility? To what degree should each and every one of us...
It's neither in both, right? It's a conversation that we need to have as a society,
yeah.
Right? And it's a conversation that we're not having as a society right now.
No, we're just watching the industry collapse around us, and the big question of what then just kind of hasn't been asked.
Yeah, and, you know, I see a lot of people out there right now fanning the flames of the media industry's destruction and celebrating it and dancing around the bonfire. But without journalists who are well compensated, or at least somewhat compensated for the work that they do, who else is going to be able to full-time and in real-time do the job of separating out what is propaganda and what is the truth?
Yeah, well, the answer is no one. Sean, you
or John Paul and Mike. John Paul and Mike.
Well, there you
bring enough sponsors, right?
Right. Exactly.
Sean, you did outstanding work on a documentary that was released in and around about 14 months ago. Tell us the response to that. What you did. What you talked about.
Yeah, so this documentary was called Whipped, The Secret World of Party Discipline, and it really was about how party discipline works, specifically in British Columbia, but in Canada as a whole. You know, one of the things that I think a misconception that people have is that they elect someone to go to the legislature who will then represent them in the legislature. And that's not what happens at all. What happens is you elect someone to be in the legislature, and then they represent your views. Supposedly, we don't know for sure, in secret cabinet and caucus meetings, for example. That's where that representation actually happens, if it does happen at all. We don't know because they're secret. And then once a decision is made by a party in those rooms, the parties come out with a decision that everyone agrees to abide by in the main. And they're not allowed to discuss the contents of those meetings, and they're not allowed to, generally speaking, dissent from the decisions made during those and other meetings. I think that this dynamic has huge consequences for our political culture in this country. If there is an assumption that decision-making has to happen in private, what does that mean for our democracy? And I actually think that assumption is held by a lot of Canadians, push come to shove. I think that assumption is held by not just provincial and federal governments. I think it's held by local governments. I think it's held by the private sector. I think it permeates our society. And that is one of many dynamics, I think, that we need to come to grips with. If we don't come to grips with that dynamic, then I think we will continue seeing the kind of lack of political engagement, lack of political knowledge that is growing within Canada.
Sean, has that changed, or has the fact that reporting and journalism changed, allowing that piece to become more protected? Because hasn't it, I mean,
it has ever been thus. It has ever been thus. You're right. It has ever been thus.
I think it got worse, though, when I can't remember who it was, but one of the acts to amend the Elections Act might have been Kretchen or Paul Martin, and they added the requirement for candidates to get the leader's signature in order to run for their party. And
I think that might have actually been Trudeau, but I could be wrong about that.
Yeah, I meant to research it before the show, but in any case. That puts a lot of power in the PMO. And, you know, people complain about Harper this and Harper that. And, you know, in some ways, there's legitimate complaints. But in other ways, he's actually kind of just a product of a very centralized, system.
I've been making that argument. My belief when it comes to the complaints about the Harper administration's secrecy is that the only difference in some ways between previous administrations and the Harper administration is that the Harper administration has exercised all of the powers afforded to it under our system of government without perhaps the same kind of velvet glove that previous administrations used. But they did use those powers. So I think what we are seeing more than anything else is simply a situation where there is less politeness in how those powers are exercised.
Right. Well, and we can't expect a Justin Trudeau government to be any different. We saw last week Justin Trudeau came out and said, essentially, if you're not pro-choice, I'm not signing your election papers, where in the past a rogue liberal electoral district could nominate a candidate with whatever views, and there wasn't that responsibility put on the leader. So it strikes me that Justin Trudeau's just as eager to exercise all the powers afforded to him as well.
I would like to also make one other point, because there has been a lot of attention focused around the power of party leaders in this country to sign off on candidates, essentially giving them the final say on who gets to run for their party and who doesn't get to run for their party. Right. And Tory backbencher Michael Chong's Reform Act would take away that authority. I think there has been a lot of praise for that. People seem concerned about that power. To my way of thinking, I think this is the power of the leader to exercise this authority is a bit of a canard. Paul, you and I have been around political parties for a fairly long time. I used to be a member of a political party, the Federal Liberal Party. I'm not sure if you're still a member of the Conservatives, but during my time as a member of the Federal Liberals, what I found astounding and very interesting was the ability of party leaders to manipulate the results of nominations even without that power. I actually think that ability to manipulate nominations without that power is far more concerning than this paper power that party leaders have. I don't think that this particular reform is going to change much when it comes to how nominations work and the level of efficacy that candidates and MPs have. I just don't think so. If a party leader wants to take someone out who is a serving MP, they're still going to be able to do that. And removing that particular paper power does very little to my way of thinking.
Unless there was a popular movement within the party, and of course the grand total of number of times we've seen that in Canada is zero.
But Paul and Sean,
but if you look at and you're your documentary talked about it. If you look at the UK with the downfall of, what's the fellow that followed Thatcher, whose name escapes me at the moment? That sort of thing would be completely unheard of, and it's certainly in the governing party in Canada.
Yes, absolutely.
Sean and Paul, to what degree, again, I'm challenging the three of us to think, to what degree is that our responsibility as a citizenry to voice our opposition, to do something about it? In other words, if I, in Saanich in the Gulf Islands, for example, which is where I live, choose to be nominated as a political representative in some sort of upcoming election, and I sign up enough people, that clearly allows me to win by a huge mm-hmm. majority. Does one honestly think that a leader or some other administration person would not sign my papers?
Well, presumably, yeah. If you were pro-life and running for the Federal Liberal Party, then the answer to that would be yes. Yeah. but there's definitely other circumstances, right? I mean, I saw this in the Conservative Party back when I was really active in politics as well. If somebody's a potential embarrassment to the party, they're going to try not to have that person win and do sort of whatever within reasonable sort of levels, I guess one could argue maybe even not reasonable. But at the end of the day, if somebody's going to embarrass the whole, and actually there's a classic example, and you guys are both old enough to remember this. There was a candidate, I believe he was from Langley, had been recorded with some fairly controversial views, and essentially implying, I can't remember if it was the Canadian Alliance or the Reform Party, but I think it was Randy White, and he was running for one of those parties, and they were doing exceedingly well, this video came out implying that a Conservative government or a Canadian Alliance government, whichever it was at the time, would essentially change the law and prevent women from having access to abortion in Canada, and it conveniently came out a couple of days before the election, and essentially changed the outcome of that particular election. I wish I could remember off the top of my head what it was, but you probably remember this, right, Sean? It was that kind of thing that happened that undoubtedly led party leaders, especially Stephen Harper, but certainly others, to want to have some control over their candidates, because there's no question in my mind that not only he won, he was in a landslide situation, but his actions in that election undoubtedly caused many other candidates who were going to win to lose and essentially change the outcome.
Michael Chong's reform bill is going to do is going to force party leaders to pay more attention to individual nomination races and ensure that they have boots on the ground in every riding that they can count on to sway those nomination races. And there's a lot of other tools that they have in their toolkit to be able to manipulate those nominations. I want to sort of go back to one of the points that John was making, which is, is this simply all not the responsibility of the citizenry? And I think it is. I really do believe that all of this is the responsibility of the citizenry. And one of the things I've wondered, and one of the things that I've thought about is just how strong civil society really is in this country. I would make a contention that I don't think it is very strong. I think we rely far too heavily on institutions, government institutions and private sector institutions, to do the governing of society for us. Mm-hmm. One need look only no further than the growth of independent legislative officers, such as the Children and Youth Representative in BC, mm-hmm. who are essentially doing a job that the opposition and civil society really should be responsible for. We download, as a citizenry, these responsibilities our citizen responsibilities onto institutions. I don't think that's good practice. I don't think it results in a very well-run or vibrant society, but it seems to be the kind of society that we want.
I'm certain that I'm not putting you on the spot. I have a feeling you've thought this through. How do we change that, Sean?
I really don't know.
We're all lazy, is what you're saying. Is that we've become complacent?
I guess there could be an argument made that we are a lazy citizenry.
Yeah.
Lazy or content?
Lazy. Lazy. And I don't know exactly. There is an argument that we are content. I've heard it before. I recently heard it at an event for the new book by Allison Loat, Tragedy in the Commons, that is sort of about some of the problems in Ottawa right now. And I was at the Manning Center here in Calgary to listen to a presentation by Allison Loat about the new book. That was one of the arguments that I heard being made in the audience, that we are content. I don't believe we are content. I believe that we are lazy, but I don't believe we're content. And I think that if we're going to get out of this rut that we are in, I think we are going to need to have some hard conversations as a society with what kind of country we want to be. What kind of society do we want to be? What kind of government do we want? These conversations, I don't think, to a certain extent, have really, in some ways, been had in a substantive way.
Right.
And I don't know how to launch those conversations.
Well, maybe this might be the beginning.
I am trying to do that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of, you know, some of the work that I'm now doing. I've launched a blog called The Unknowable Country that is covering some of these kind of issues. I hope to start more of a conversation about that, and I hope to bring more people together to comment on these issues and talk about these issues so that we do have a more robust debate going on about what kind of society do we want.
What is the name of the blog again, please?
It's called The Unknowable Country, and you can find it at seanholman.com.
Ah, excellent.
And tell me, I know you spoke at the Open Data Conference in February, and the topic, I believe, was The Unknowable Country. So can you give us the synopsis of that?
Yeah, I mean, basically the synopsis is that as a result of this sort of assumption that we have, that meetings, that decision-making has to happen in private, as a result of our poisonous PR culture, as a result of the limitations of our freedom of information laws, and as a result of the limitations of public records in this country, we do live in, to a certain extent, an unknowable country, a country that is very, very difficult to map out what actually is happening. So I'm in the process of building that argument. I'm in the process of expanding on that argument, and I may be wrong. I may very well be wrong. But I think it's, at the very least, a good exercise to engage in.
So, Sean, you know, I hear what you're saying, but the skeptic in me also says we live in this incredible information age where so much knowledge is available at our fingertips. And somewhere deep down, I want to think that, if you compare the situation today with, say, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, that in some regard we have to be further ahead in this regard, or are we not? Is it getting worse, and it's worse than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago?
I think availability, accessibility of some data has increased, but the amount of data collection, I suspect, has decreased in some key areas. I do think that it has gotten worse. I all of this is speculative. But I think, you know, for example, the Freedom of Information Act and the Access to Information Act, did that actually, to a certain extent, impede access? Did that reduce the citizen responsibility of people in government to disclose things that were happening in government, to talk about things that were happening in government? You know, I don't quite know the answer to the question that you're asking. It's a question that I'm trying to answer.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, given the internet and given the flow of information there, it strikes me that a lot of the information that should be accessible, especially to journalists, there should be channels that are available. I kind of assume, you know, if I look at any industry and I want to find industry-specific knowledge, there's channels that you can access on the online that maybe, you know, ordinary folks just wouldn't know about or look
but
at.
But not in Canada.
Okay.
I am constantly struck by the lack of availability of some of the key data that you're talking about in this country. It's astonishing what we do not know. And that what simply is not tracked, especially in comparison to a country like the United States.
Sean and Paul, especially this question's for Paul. You are co-founder of, in my opinion, the most successful social media conference in North America. It's called Social Media Camp. It was held in Victoria a couple weeks ago, and it's now been going on for 5 years. Comment to me, please, on the following. So to date, and it might be a naive opinion, even though we all have access to phenomenal amounts of information and amounts access to people, at this point we seem to be saying it's red, it's green, it's blue. When do you sense that someone's going to say, what does that mean? And this is what it means. Mm-hmm. Do you sense that sort of collective analysis of the information as opposed to just the presentation of the information?
Well, and I'm not entirely sure what you're getting at, John, but, you know, there's within the miracle that is social media and that is, you know, the free flow of information, there is a lot of pitfalls, you know, for people. One of my biggest complaints, especially when it comes to politics, is the ability of people to silo themselves to new ideas. So they, rather than you know, the right winger reading the left wing blogs or the left winger reading the right wing blogs, what they do instead is gather around ideas. You know, I like this page about, you know, stopping this politician or this cause or whatnot, and don't take any time, because they're not exposed to it, to hear the other side.
These things are seen as news.
Yeah, exactly.
These are things are I get the sense, right, that in some quarters the information that is being provided by these advocacy websites, by these sites that take a position, is being perceived not as activism, not as advocacy, but as news.
Yeah, and I said this years ago.
Right.
Take the craziest idea that you can possibly think of, and go on to Facebook or go on to, you know, Reddit or one of these other sites, and I guarantee you, you will find a number of like-minded people already collected together that you can then, you know, talk about amongst yourselves about how amazing and revolutionary and important this insane idea is that you have. And that aspect, I think, is the most dangerous part of social media, because you know, we see it all too often. It's very easy for people just to kind of shut out the things that they don't that are challenging to them, right? And I think that leads to complacency and laziness as well. I want to get back a little bit to freedom of information, though, Sean. I know you spoke at the Canadian Association of Journalists annual meeting, was it?
Yes, regarding your annual convention.
Annual convention, yeah. And I know your topic was the various freedom of information issues. We talked a little bit about that. Was there any other sort of huge parts of that that we didn't sort of cover in the last segment in there?
No, the only thing that I would add, and I spoke with Kirk LaPointe, the former managing editor of the Vancouver Sun, during that presentation. He was my other panelist. He made some fantastic points. The one additional point that I would kind of bring up is that when you take a look at freedom of information in this country and the freedom of information system, which is often subject to complaint as a result of the cost of the requests, as a result of the currency of the responses provided, as a result of the completeness of the responses provided, a lot of that revolves around the exemptions in the Act, and the exceptions in the Act, which allow government to essentially censor information going out the door before it is made public. So I think we should really start conceiving freedom of information in this country as more of a censorship system more than anything else. It's a censorship system which is designed to keep certain kinds of information out of public hands. And what does that mean for us as a country?
Speaking of frightening concepts, another topic that came up at the CAJ was drones and the use of drones, I presume, within media. I hadn't really thought about that, but, you know, this is very topical. People are, you know, expecting that drones will be the delivery agents of the future and, perhaps deal the death blow to any notion of privacy that we might have. Tell me what the gist of that was.
Yeah, basically, these are drones, robots, flying robots that have cameras mounted on them.
Yeah.
And it is a huge cost reducer in a sense. Previously, we had to have helicopters for these kinds of shots or planes for these kind of shots. Now we can do it on the cheap. You know, there has been a lot of privacy worries about these kinds of drones. I'm actually less concerned about privacy, really, than a lot of people are. It does bother me, you know, when major institutions are able to collect information, but it bothers me more when major institutions are able to collect information the public does not have access to.
Right.
You know, if information is being collected, it should be made available to all. And I think it's really the fortification of that information and the exclusivity of that information that is causing a lot of the problems, not necessarily its collection, although there are some concerns obviously associated with that.
So, Sean, right. we're likely getting to the end of our session today. I would really hope that we can talk to you again. But as a potentially a fun way to end, give us some...
What we're going to do, actually, John, here is we're going to actually tie in This Week in Politics and include Sean in that segment this week.
And how are we going to do that?
Because he's a man who knows a few things about politics. Well, why don't we talk about a couple of the since actually today I'm in Victoria. John, where are you today?
I'm in Edmonton.
You're in Edmonton, and Sean is in Calgary.
I am.
So why don't we talk a little bit about Alberta-BC relations?
Sure.
I guess the first thing is, I don't even know if you've been paying attention, Sean, but you know we have a new NDP leader here in British Columbia?
Mm-hmm.
And any thoughts?
You know, I really like John. I think that he brings to the position of NDP leader an enormous number of talents. I think he brings a talent for public speaking, a talent for retail politics, a talent for expressing his ideas, and a substantive intellect, which is certainly not by any stretch of the imagination a disadvantage when it comes to being a political leader. As with any leader, he does come with some liabilities. So it'll be up to his office and the people that he surrounds himself with to manage those liabilities. A lot of his success, as would be the case with Christy Clark, is going to be determined by a wide variety of factors, only a small number of which are the qualities that he personally has.
Right. I think it's striking that we have we have two leaders now that you could both describe as being charismatic. And we haven't seen a lot of that in BC politics really, for quite a long time. And so it'll be interesting to see on the charisma charts how the two fare against each other in the next election.
It certainly will be.
I think that John, like any other NDP/potentially left-wing ideology-based party, has to deal with how do we balance an environment and a resource-based economy. I think of any of the leaders, he will have a shot at being able to articulate that. We have to wait and see. If he can, then we will have a viable opposition in this province.
Yeah, I was just going to carry on with the next point here. So we had a bit of a meltdown in Alberta, and the Tory party in charge ousted their leader and have replaced her now. What happened there, Sean? And what do you think of the new person and their chances specifically versus Wild Rose or any other sort of up-and-coming competitors?
Well, as someone who's studied party discipline, I always find these sort of instances where there is a revolt against a party leader to be fascinating. What I am really often curious about is why do these revolts take place? What is the dynamic that comes into play, especially given the extraordinary level of party discipline that is in existence? Is it that MLAs feel that they are not able to speak up publicly? I don't think so. I think oftentimes it's when MLAs don't feel like they have a lot of efficacy internally, that they don't feel like they are being listened to internally, which, when that changes, may do something for them, but I'm not sure if it does anything for the voter. So
right.
I suppose when Alison Redford was ousted from power, that was sort of what was on my mind. How much will this really help the public, and how much is this simply about MPs complaining about their work environment, essentially?
Do you think there will be a thaw now in BC-Alberta relations, that certainly the Redford-Christie dynamic seemed to be hostile? Do you think that's gonna thaw a little bit now?
I think it's too early to say, and I'm not really close enough to the situation, I think, to make an informed speculation on that particular issue.
So do you think, speaking of speculation, do you think this Northern Gateway pipeline is ever going to happen, or is it inevitable, or, what's going on there?
I don't know.
I mean, there's certainly alternatives.
I really honestly don't know the answer to that question either. It's such a complex question.
Yeah.
And
it certainly is. There's so many stakeholders, and frankly, so many stakeholders that are not in favor, and that have so many institutional vehicles, i.e., legal, by which to stop these things. I suspect that. That the solution to that problem will likely come through an already existing pipeline through the southern end of BC.
And honestly, I actually find the liquid natural gas development issue to be far more interesting than the pipeline issue.
Mm-hmm.
The development of LNG
Well, there was a Christy Clark and her government are fundamentally changing the education system in the province to try to accommodate that political objective. Fascinating stuff. I suppose not altogether bad. I'm here in Edmonton looking at a prosperous community. I'm looking at a lot of young people that can afford to live here that are making, I suspect, enough money to live and grow, have a future. That's not happening in some communities in British Columbia, and people want that. That's not such a bad thing.
One has to think about the consequences of that, though.
Mm.
They're putting the oil on the trains. You know, I mean, I'm all for safety. But, you know, I mean, if they're so concerned about having the oil coming down, putting it on a train is no better. Mm-hmm. And you're still going to load it up in tankers, and you're still going to run the tankers down the coast. So unless there's, you know, unless there's some broad sweeping, and I'm sure environmentalists, you know, in this province would love the idea, but some broad sweeping total ban, which it would be impossible because of Alaska anyway. You know, it's just, this is just something we have to deal with. And I like the fact that, you know, there's some pushback and that, you know, people are making noise about safety and about, you know, other concerns. I think that's great. But, at the end of the day, you know, Alberta has a product the world wants, and, like it or not, the world's going to get it. So whether they get it through British Columbia or whether they get it through some other, you know, system, they're going to get it. So I guess for me, it's just a question of, you know, how, you know, what's the best way to make that happen. And, you know, Alberta's got three or four good options. Now, they don't need us to agree with this.
No, but I think there is a greater cause to talk about the consequences of that development. And I see the consequences of that development every single day. And they are not environmental, or they are not only environmental. They are social not very good consequences. Yes, you may have jobs. Yes, you may have high incomes, but I would argue that the price of those jobs and incomes may not be worth it, and not just from an environmental standpoint, but also from a social standpoint.
What are you seeing, Sean?
Tell us more.
Well, you know, for example, the province that I am now in, Alberta, has the highest wage difference between men and women in the entire country. And that is, I am sure, as a result of the oil and gas industry.
Right.
If you are able to get a job in the oil and gas industry with only a high school education, what does that do to the post-secondary environment and the kind of jobs and the kind of development that occurs when you have a population where there is a great amount of post-secondary education, or there is a more of an emphasis on that.
And it's been stated that could be one of the consequences of this reworking of the education curriculum here in BC.
Well, yeah.
That it is the start of a potential slow death of a liberal arts education.
Yes,
it's not the start, John. We're midway through that. The reality for a long time. I mean, if I wanted to go get a job working for government, I'd have a difficult time because I did not finish a degree in university. But I left to take a far higher paying job at the time than what I would have gotten if I had graduated with all of my student loans in place. And you know, a lot of kids today, their kids aren't stupid. They're gonna have a look at that, and they're gonna say, well, let me see, I can go straight into this job, you know, rucking, carrying stuff around and whatever, you know, hard labor sort of stuff that I need to do that's going to earn me three times what I would earn in some office job after getting my liberal arts degree that would take me 15 years to pay off my student loans for. John, which one are you going to pick if you're, you know, 18-year-old coming out of high school today?
Well, I would suggest to you that this actually forms part of the problem to Sean's earlier comments around a lazy or either uninformed electorate, is that a liberal arts education is not simply a study of history or psychology. It actually it trains one's mind to think. You learn to think. And if we start to abandon this capacity to try to train people to think, as opposed to training them to deal with metal or wood or vehicles, I think that's not a good thing.
But I think a great counter argument as somebody who is a college dropout and have trained myself to think, you know, you look at the censorship and what goes on, and it's certainly no, you know, not knowing the situation in the institution you're with, Sean, but you know, the free thinking university of the past strikes me as long gone anyway, and you know, really many programs, it strikes me, post secondary school, and if you think I'm wrong, please say so, are very, very narrow, and you know, sort of formulate opinions for people, and don't encourage certainly free speech.
Well, that was not my experience, and certainly with professors tenured, there's an opportunity for them to say what they want. Is there an envelope on freedom of speech? Well, that could be for another show. But I do worry about so much concentration on trade. But nonetheless, it's the
John,
way
do you
things
think I'm
going.
Out to lunch with that? I think
what we saw in the past week with the dean of a school being removed, stripped of tenure, later offered back that tenure, but stripped of tenure and also removed from his position as dean is worrisome.
Yeah.
It is worrisome. Is that a sign of overall academic culture in this country? I don't know the answer to that question.
Yeah, fair enough. And you know, I'd hate to overgeneralize, but certainly, you know, you see stories like that, and you wonder what's happened. But you're right, John, that is a podcast for another day. I'd love to close with this, because we can't possibly do be speaking to somebody who's such an expert on journalism as yourself, Sean, without asking you this very important question. I'm going to preamble it a little bit. On my smart TV, I cut the cable about a year and a half ago, and so I went out and bought a smart TV. And on my smart TV, I can stream Al Jazeera, Russia Today, no propaganda there. I can stream BBC, the other big UK news channel. I can't get any American news channels, but interestingly, I cannot stream Canadian news channels. I cannot for free get CTV, or actually for that matter, to pay for it. I cannot get CTV News One, and I cannot get CBC News World. My understanding of the CBC and the mandate of the CBC was that they're supposed to be available for all, and you know, that's kind of the whole idea is to make it accessible. At the moment, Al Jazeera is more accessible to my family as a news source than the CBC. And I wonder if I could preamble that into what's the future of the CBC and in particular public broadcasting in Canada.
Not good, but then again, I also think that is not just as a result of the budget cuts that the Conservatives have brought into place when it comes to the CBC. You know, the CBC, I think, in a lot of ways has been a huge missed opportunity. I don't think, in my view, that they have always spent the money that has been made available and the opportunity that has been afforded to them very well. But that all being said, what I am also concerned about, too, is the decline in government funding overall for these kinds of ventures. Rightly or wrongly, I think, unfortunately, Canadian culture, to a certain extent, has been dependent upon government funding. This goes back to the sort of institutionalization of our culture. And when you start hacking away at those institutions, what are we left with? If civil society is not capable and not used to doing some of these functions, what do we have?
Right.
Yeah.
That's something that Canadians need to grapple with.
Yeah, that's a great question to end our session today. Sean, this has been great. We miss you here in Victoria.
Come visit.
Oh, sorry.
I miss you guys, too. Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, huge congratulations on your documentary. I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. And I know it's streaming on CPAC. If people haven't seen it, they really got to go see this. It's called Whipped. And, it's a real eye-opener. So congratulations again, Sean. That was very impressive.
And it sounds like we posed, in some instances, more questions than we answered. So I hope you'll allow
us to
chat.
That's what this is all about.
I hope you'll allow us to chat with you again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
All right.
Okay, you guys take care. Bye now.
Have a great day.